23rd on Mondays starting at 4 p.m. Stay tuned for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins, and this is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Here's some advice for your friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man!
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you've tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches, enough welfare for everyone.
It's Leon Thomas on vocals, Johnny Hodges on alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York of 1970. Before that, the unmistakable voice of Humphrey Bogart playing the tough guy newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer, there's no way, baby, to stop a free press. My name's Tom Robbins, and that's where I cop the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. Beginning back in 2014, a decade ago already, I wrote a series of articles for the Marshall Project and the New York Times. They were focused on instances of brutality by guards at New York's prisons. One story I did was about a near-fatal beating of a man at Attica Prison that resulted in a decision by corrections officials to line the walls and prison tiers of that notorious upstate facility with cameras. And it took them a while, but after the cameras were installed, the number of incidents of abuse plummeted. The cameras had made a big difference. A couple of years later, however, I wrote again for the Times and the Marshall Project about an even more stunning episode, I think, that took place at the Mid-State Correctional Facility in Marcy, New York, near Utica. There, a squad of guards with the apparent knowledge of ranking officers and even senior prison officials had run amok through a dormitory in that medium security facility, beating, harassing, and in several cases, sodomizing people with metal objects. It was an unprovoked attack that lasted over an hour. Guards smashed property, spewed food and soap atop residents as they lay prone on the floor. People were beaten. Guy had his head put through a wall, kicked and cursed as the guards ran through the dormitory. No cameras were present. And as you'll hear in a moment, guards later warned the victims that there would be more beatings if word of the episode reached the outside world. But word did get out, and lawyers at a New York City firm that has long represented victims of abuse in New York's prison stepped in, alerting state officials in Albany. Last month, a judge issued a ruling that New York State was legally culpable and liable for those beatings. The more than two dozen men who brought the suit and who suffered those beatings are now seeking compensation. There'll be a second trial on that that'll take place in the next few months. But even a decade after that series of articles that ran on the front page of the Times, they made a big deal at the time. A decade later, just days after that judge's ruling in the Mid-State case, a judge issued a ruling that a prisoner was beaten to death at a Marcy Correctional Facility, which is just across the street from Mid-State. That incident was recorded on cameras, and because there was video footage of it, it's caused an uproar. The governor, who had never previously addressed brutal assaults like the one that took place at Mid-State, she's called for 14 employees, I think all but one of them are guards, to be fired. There's a criminal investigation underway. Even the union representing the officers, a union that's never in the past spoken harshly or condemned any such incidents of abuse, the union has spoken out, disassociating itself with the actions depicted in that video. As it happens, at least two of the guards involved in the beating fatality across the street at Marcy also took part in the mass attack at Mid-State back in 2016. Why is that not a shock? So, a decade later, we're still talking about the same kind of stuff. People are still suffering beatings and death. But tonight, we're going to talk about that case that I wrote about back in 2016. One of the plaintiffs in the Mid-State lawsuit, one of the victims, is a fellow named Cole Bryant, who is with us this evening. Also with us is Glenn Miller, a partner in the firm of Siven & Miller, which brought the case and who spent almost a decade trying to win justice for the victims. Welcome, Cole and Glenn. Thanks so much for being here this evening.
Hi, Tom.
Yes, hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks so much for being here. Keep both of you, keep your voices up good and loud so we can hear you out here in radio land. Listen, it's a long, complicated story, but let's try to start at the beginning. And Cole, where were you? This took place on July 6, 2016. Where were you at that time?
I was an incarcerated individual at Mid-State Correctional Facility, housed in dorm 4H.
And this took place early in the morning, is my understanding.
Mid-morning, closer to noon. Yes.
And were you getting ready to go to breakfast? What were you doing, and what did you hear and see?
We had just come from breakfast, and people were going back into the dorm to get ready for whatever work assignment they might have had. And then before that can happen, a busload full of correctional officers offloaded, ran through into the building and then up into the 4-H dorm, screaming at the top of their voices, telling everyone to get down on the floor where they were, stand there.
And what did you see them do? What happened to you personally, Cole Bryant?
Personally, I was headed towards the room. I was able to make it back to the room, back to my dorm room, which is a four-man room. And once I was there, I complied with all their orders.
They told you to lie down. You said stay prone on the ground. And then what?
Told us to lie down face first in the ground, and then they came in and they proceeded to ransack the place, snatching people, grabbing them, abusing them, beating them. Just an awful event.
When you say beatings, these are striking out with fists, clubs, kicks. What were they?
Most of them were gloved, and they were striking out with blows. And in other cases, they were taking tools and bashing walls or taking the beds apart, throwing them at inmates and smashing them on and throwing the lockers on top of them, these things.
Throwing lockers on top of them. Cole Bryant, how many people roughly were in the dorm that morning when this episode began?
I want to say over 40.
Uh-huh. And did this go on throughout the dorm, or was it just limited to a couple of rooms?
No, all the dorms, from the rec room all the way back into the rooming areas.
Had you ever seen anything like that before?
Never seen anything like that. I've been through many searches in the MAX facilities, and yeah, that was unique. Hmm. Even duress searches don't go like that. It was definitely a departure from anything I'd ever seen.
And what were the officers saying as they went through ransacking everybody's room? What were they talking about? What were they?
They were saying, this is our jail. And they began to use racial epithets.
I should remind you that profanity is not allowed on FCC. They might have used some words that you don't want to repeat right now, but just give us a sense of the kind of language they were using, if you would.
Absolutely. They would probably not make the census.
Was it racial?
Yep, racial in tone, a lot of it, and then just insulting. And that's in between the physical abuse, stomps, kicks, punches, smashing people's heads in the doors, in the walls, into heating mechanisms.
Uh-huh. And what happened to you yourself? Were you struck?
Yes, I was. I was struck several times. I was stomped in the back several times, and then I was kicked in the head fiercely, trying to get me to comply to keep my face straight down so I couldn't see what else was going on in the room. And I had my head pulled up, my neck hyperextended. And the injuries subsequently caused a partial herniated disc, left me injured, and still dealing with that injury even today.
So there's a complicated story about what set them off and why this raid, this ransacking of the dorm had taken place. What were the guards claiming the reason behind the raid was that morning?
Okay, so there were two different stories in it. I have to tell both so you can see the presumption on both sides. So the inmates that were out in the recreation area greeted the guard that came in that morning. He went into his bubble, closed the door, sat in his chair, kicked his feet up, and fell while sleeping. The inmates that were in the recreation area got scared and called for the higher-ups. The higher-ups came in and thought that the inmates who had called them had attacked the officer.
So there was an officer whose duty was to sort of keep an eye on folks, and he was this his regular job, to sit there and just sort of observe?
Yes, make sure there isn't any really real trouble. That was what he was supposed to do.
Uh-huh. And what would he do? Would he read a book? Was he dozing off? What was his usual pattern when he would do this?
To be quite honest, I don't know his usual pattern. I was just new in the dorm myself. So I had only been there maybe 4 or 5 days before this whole incident happened. I hadn't seen all the guards, but the ones, the inmates that did call for the higher-ups didn't know the guard.
And the inmates' version was that they called for help because of the fact this guy was injured. He was bleeding. This guard had fallen out of his chair and hit his head somehow, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. But the guards didn't believe that story. They believed something else had happened. What did they think had happened?
They believed that someone had gotten into the bubble, which would be almost impossible because it locks from the inside, struck the man while he was sleeping with a weapon of some sort, and then left him bleeding on the floor, and then called the higher-ups to come over and get him.
Well, it's quite a story. Glenn Miller, your law firm, you and Ed Siven at Siven & Miller, the law firm that's handled so many of these cases, why don't you pick up the story here? Why don't you tell us about your firm and how you folks got word about this incident and what you did when you heard about it.
Well, when we first heard about it, it was a phone call from one of the incarcerated individual's mothers who heard about it through another incarcerated individual who got wind of what happened. And the reason it had to take that route is because the incarcerated individuals in the 4-H dorm was sequestered. Their phone lines were cut. They were not allowed to go to the mess hall. They were threatened if they made any calls to the outside or informed anyone from the outside. So for a number of weeks, we had 40-plus incarcerated individuals scared to do anything because of repercussions if they did. One very brave incarcerated individual by the name of Raymond Brockley, who's no longer with us and who shared a room with Cole, got a letter out to his mother, you know, as I said, through other incarcerated individuals. Once we got that letter, we immediately informed Albany. And that is when Internal Affairs got on the case. And Internal Affairs started their investigation into this incident over 4 weeks after it occurred.
A month later. So it wasn't exactly a fresh trail, was it? If there were injuries, it would have been hard to track the injuries at that point. Cole, were there people who had sought medical help after the raid on the dorm that day?
They were unable to. They wouldn't let anyone out the door or to put in the thick core slips, which were necessary in order to get down to the infirmary. So no one was able to seek help.
So
within several days, at least a week, no one was able to get help. Eventually, some people passed out and had to get taken over to the infirmary for lack of medication, for things of that nature, because they just wouldn't let people go over there.
Literally passed out. And this is like over 24 people we're talking about who are suffering the physical results of this beating that had gone on.
Exactly.
So, Cole, Glenn Miller just mentioned the name of Raymond Brockley, who I met with when I wrote my story for the Marshall Project in the Times back in, I guess, November of that year. And sadly, as Glenn mentions, Ray has since passed away. But he was in your dorm room. Did you see what happened to him?
That's the point I was making about being kicked in the head to make sure I couldn't see. So everything... had to basically hear what was going on.
What did you hear?
First, obviously, I heard the beds cracking and the locker come down on him. And I heard him over there pulling Raymond from under the locker. And then I heard a statement, which was, this is what it feels like to be helpless.
Okay.
Yeah, what it feels like to be helpless. According to Raymond, at that time, the man had sodomized him.
Raymond said they took some kind of object. He wasn't sure what it was. It felt metallic and just jammed it up his rectum.
And then that statement. So I could only hear the statement because my head was smashed in. I'd already got it stomped in and beat on pretty good. Didn't want to be looking, but I could hear what was going on in the room.
Glenn Miller, Raymond Brockley wasn't the only incarcerated person on the dorm that morning who complained about that kind of sodomy, that kind of crazy sexual attack. There were others.
There was one other individual who was sodomized with the same type of an object. There was another individual who was physically groped in his genitals and humiliated. And also assaulted at the same time. And then there was another individual who was going through transition, who was taking hormones and actually had developed some breast at the time. And they actually groped that person as well, using awful, profane language against that person.
Right. I interviewed that guy as well during the time that I was visiting people in the wake of that. You know, both of you are experienced in this field, sadly. I mean, Cole Bryant, you were behind bars for a long period of time. Glenn, you've done many of these cases. Let me ask you both individually. Start with you, Cole. Was this different from anything that you'd encountered prior?
Absolutely. It was probably the worst encounter. I've been through several searches throughout the years. I was about 12 years into my incarceration when this happened. And nothing before it, nothing prior to that had come even close.
Yeah. Glenn, I mean, the thing that stood out for me when you and your partner, Ed Sivan, contacted me was the mass scale of this, just the number of perpetrators, the fact that there were more than 24 guards and there were more than 24 men inside this dorm, all of whom were attacked and brutalized in some way. Is that has this been different from, you've done so many of these cases. Does this one stand out to you?
It does. It does, Tom. And what, you know, there are a number of reasons why this one stands out. I think the most important reason is that this came from on top. The superintendent, two deputy superintendents, captains, lieutenants, not only did they participate in the planning of this, but they actually were present in the dorm at one time or another during that morning. And in fact, I believe one of the lieutenants who testified during the trial said when the superintendent walked through the dorm, he congratulated his men on doing a great job.
Hmm.
This particular superintendent eventually resigned under pressure. But what sets this apart from, Tom, the other hundreds of cases that I have litigated is that the superintendent was actually present and was aware of what was going on.
Hmm. You know, it's funny, when I was reporting out the story, officials at the state's Department of Corrections told me in a written statement that the superintendent and his deputy had both been suspended. But as I read through the decision that was issued by the trial judge in the New York Court of Claims, I noted that the state investigator said that the superintendent had resigned or retired just as the investigation was beginning. Do we know which is true, Glenn?
Well, we do know that he resigned during the course of this investigation. What we don't know is what was said to him internally, but we do know that he does collect his pension. One can infer that his resignation was in exchange for, a normal retirement with a pension. And that's what's happening right now.
Mm. Okay. Folks, this is WBAI 99.5 FM, streaming live at WBAI.org. The show's called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins, but more importantly, I'm talking about this issue that just won't go away, which is brutality behind bars on people who are already been serving their time, which is supposed to be their punishment, but are all too frequently subject to the kinds of brutality that we've seen in this case that we're talking about, and we've now seen echoed in the most recent incident with the death of a man right across the street from Mid-State at Marcy State Prison. Glenn, let me just go back to the TikTok of how what transpired. You were gathering, letters, affidavits or narratives from people who had been the victims in this case. And what were you telling the state officials at that time as you were hearing about continuing threats, that kind of thing that Cole was just talking about, people being warned not to talk about this?
Yeah, well, eventually once the word got out that my firm was involved in this, we were receiving continual letters from the incarcerated individuals in this dorm. And the letters were very consistent with the fact that they were being threatened with physical harm, with being put in special housing unit, which is solitary confinement. Some were being threatened that their release date would be extended if they said anything. So at some point, we wrote a letter to the commissioner in Albany, basically informing him about these threats. And we said that we told him if these threats don't end, we will take further action. And that's sort of the first time, to my knowledge, that Albany got involved in this case.
Was there any indication prior to that Albany, that the commissioner or the commissioner's people were aware of what had happened, or had Mid-State's officials kept a lid on it themselves and word had not leaked out to other people in the system, do you think?
No. I mean, number one, the short answer to your question, Tom, is that the officials at Midstate kept it under seal. In fact, when OSI came to the facility...
OSI is the Office of Special Investigations, right?
Yes, it's the Internal Affairs of the Department of Corrections. They came to the facility on July 8th, which is 2 days after this incident, to investigate the injury to this officer back on July 3rd.
The guy who we think fell out of his chair, but who the officers thought had been attacked, right? Okay.
Yes, the guy who fell out of his chair. And during that trip, OSI spoke to the superintendent, in addition to speaking to the deputy superintendent for security and other members of the brass, and not one of them mentioned to OSI anything that occurred on July 6th, just 2 days earlier.
Well, you know, in the judge's decision, he quotes from some of the trial testimony. By the way, how long did this trial in the Court of Claims go on for, Glenn Miller?
It went on for a long time. I'd say altogether last summer, the summer of 2023, it took about 4 weeks to try this case.
4 weeks of testimony from everybody that was summoned to the stand, a lot of the victims as well as some of the officials, guards, whatnot.
27 claimants testified during the case. Unfortunately, Raymond Brockley could not testify. And then there were about a dozen to two dozen officials from DOCS who testified.
Well, I was going to say that in the judge's decision, he seems to point out the fact that one of the deputies had told an official at one point that she saw a chair that had been thrust against the wall and embedded so deeply into the wall that all four legs were still stuck in the wall. It's just this crazy description, and that she had laughed about it at the time. That would seem like pretty difficult stuff to ignore, and yet we know that the superintendent did a walkthrough at some point that morning.
That's correct. And to make it maybe even more laughable, each person who testified from the Department of Corrections, and as I said, there were a couple of dozen people who were in the dorm that morning, each one of them denied ever seeing a chair in the wall. Each person denied ever seeing holes in the wall. There were, I would say altogether, Cole, you can correct me if I'm off, between 50 and 100 holes in the wall, all from the legs of chairs. And not one corrections officer noticed one hole.
Cole, does that match your recollection, all these holes in the walls from
It does match. And over the weeks after the holes were there, they came in to fill in the holes with spackling.
Uh-huh. They tried to spackle them over, so that it wasn't there anymore. It is almost laughable, but it must have been terrifying as it was going on. Cole, let me ask you, after Glenn Miller and his associates reached out to Albany and there began an investigation, did conditions change in the dorm or in the facility after that? Was there still the same kind of threats going on, or did they back off a little bit?
There still were threats early on, and then OSI finally came down to make sure everybody got to see the doctor. And from that point on, things began to simmer down a little bit. Hmm. But there were still matters that they were doing, like couldn't get certain things that you might have need. We're going into the winter. Any clothes or anything that they were ruined, state clothes that they ruined, couldn't get those back. Statements like, can't get my officer back, so you can't get your clothing, your proper attire back, things of this nature. So they were softer. They weren't as abusive, like physically abusive, but there were still abuses of authority going on.
So specifically
toward the people that made the claim.
Were people still fearful at that point, Cole, that this could happen again?
I can't speak for anyone else, but I was.
You were?
Yes.
And why was that?
Well, I'd seen it happen once. There wasn't really any protections why they couldn't do it again. Mm-hmm. And then they're already in trouble, so they knew they were in trouble. Doing it again would have just been easy for them.
Terrifying. All right, listen, we're going to take a short musical break with a tune that's at least related to this subject. Ray G. Johnson, we got this song queued up.
Quite freely, no younger than 12, no older than 17, thrown in like bandits and cast off like criminals, all inside the walls on the grounds of Red Wing. From the dirty old mess hall to the brick wall, too weary to talk and too tired to sing, and it's all afternoon you remember your hometown. This thing, and it's keep down your head and stay in your number. Takes you to the screen. Farewell to the minutes they threaten you with it. All inside the grounds of the walls of Red Wing.
Walls of Red Wing. That's Bob Dylan. You know, I went to see the new movie this past week about that. Complete Unknown. I'm a Dylan fan. I was curious what they'd do with it. But I was reminded that Bob Dylan had written this song very early in his career. Red Wing was a juvenile detention facility, as I understand it, and as he indicates in the lyrics there. But I always thought that melody and the way he sang the tune describes some of the places that I visited over the years in writing stories about people in New York State held behind high walls. Cole Bryant, when you got to Midstate, I'm curious. It's a medium security facility. Did that suggest to you that it was going to be somewhat less intense and that the fear factor would be less there?
It was really a culture shock. In the max facility, you mostly have your own cell, so you're locked in during the night. These facilities are really open, so there's a lot of day sleeping or rooms with three or four people in there. I didn't see any real challenges right away, but I thought that the layout was probably dangerous should something go awry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That was one of the conundrums of this story, the fact that this mass raid took place in a medium security facility. Most of the stories I'd written about prior to that had been in maximums, where places like Attica and Clinton. And, other places, but this one really stood out. And I must say, when I visited there, the attitude of the guards, as they often are, not fairly friendly to people who come to visit folks who are incarcerated there. You know, they were certainly less than happy to receive me. I guess they knew what I was up to, since I was talking to people who had all been in 4-H when I went in. Glenn Miller, in your advocacy on behalf of this, these folks over the years, it's been a long time now, gosh, 8 years, going on 9. But you ran up against something in the state law, or rather, I guess, in the interpretations of it by judges, which was kind of an amazing argument. And I don't want to get too deep into the legal weeds here, but I gather from reading the judge's opinion issued last month that the state was claiming that the things that the officers did in any kind of brutality, and specifically any sexual acts like these sodomized acts that we were just talking about, were, quote, outside the scope of the officer's employment, and therefore the state should not be liable for them. What's that all about, if you could explain it to us who are not lawyers?
Yeah, okay. And I'll try not to get into the legal weeds either. Let me make 2 points with regard to this case. Outside the scope means that the officers are acting outside what they're supposed to be doing on their job, outside what they've been trained to do. So let's put aside the sexual assaults for a second. In this case, they were by all means acting within the scope, because they were instructed to do this by their supervisors, by the superintendent and by the deputy superintendents and, you know, other supervisors. So their argument with regard, the state's argument with regard to acting outside the scope, really fell on deaf ears from the very beginning. The sexual assaults, the sodomies and the fondlings, those were a much more interesting issue. Because one could argue that those type of acts could under no circumstances be within the scope of their authority. Our argument stated differently. What we argued was that sodomizing or groping or fondling people were not sexual acts. They were acts of violence, similar to kicks to the teeth or punches to the ribs, or any other assault, and it would make no sense to carve out the sodomies and the fondlings just because one could argue that they were of a sexual nature. I had to show in my argument that these acts were not done for sexual gratification, which of course they were not. They were done to demean. They were done in a violent way, similar to kicking and punching. And the judge agreed with us. He said there was nothing different from the kicks and the punches, and therefore everything they did to these incarcerated individuals were within the scope of their authority, because they were following the orders of the superintendent.
And the reason that, you know, we should just make clear to listeners who might be surprised to sort of understand that, who defends the state in the court of claims when you bring these cases, Glenn Miller? Who are the lawyers?
The lawyers work for they're assistant attorney generals, and they work for the office of Letitia James, who is the state attorney general, and they all work in her office.
Yeah, that's one of the ironies of these cases, which is Letitia James, who has rightfully a reputation as a pretty progressive lawmaker, but her job is to defend employees of the state, and they seem to take that very seriously, because they had won an earlier case at the highest state in the highest court in the state, the Court of Appeals, which I gather made your work, your job, even tougher, because they had actually succeeded, I think, in convincing that panel or a majority of that panel, that one particularly vicious attack on an inmate that had happened several years ago in a different prison, that it was such a gratuitous act of violence that it was outside the scope of employment. Do I have that roughly right, Glenn, in terms of the...
You do. That case is called Rivera versus State. And in that case, a corrections officer, for no apparent reason other than to be nasty, took a disabled incarcerated individual off of a line in the mess hall and just started beating on him just for joy, for his own gratification. And the State Court of Appeals, which is our highest court, ruled that an act like that is outside the scope of his authority. Because, frankly, Tom, it was so brutal and so gratuitous that the state should not be responsible for it. What Ed and I have been doing over the years, and other lawyers who do what we do, is we've been chipping away at the Rivera case. And one of the things that this case has accomplished is that we took a big chip out of the Rivera case by prevailing on the sexual assaults.
Well, I was going to ask you, like, how important is this judge's decision? It's a lower-level court, but at the same time, he's made this ruling. Is this going to have impact anywhere else, do you think, down the line?
Well, you know, right now, as you said, it's the lower court, and the state can either roll the dice and appeal it to the appellate division, or they can let it go. And, you know, and we talk about our progressive attorney general. I'd like to think that, you know, she should, accept it as good law, because these are not sexual assaults. These are violent attacks on incarcerated individuals.
You know, I haven't asked you this question. Cole, I don't know if you know, but what was the discipline? Was anybody disciplined while you were there, Cole, and for what happened that day in July?
I'm not sure I understand the question. When you say, was someone disciplined?
I should ask it on both sides. Were any of the inmates disciplined after that?
Quite a few. Anyone who tried to go against what they were saying, that they were trying to force us to do, the discipline, beaten pretty heartily, taken to solitary confinement, some shipped outside of jail. So, and on the other side, several suspensions happened during a period of time. Several of the brass left, not everyone, but I think you mentioned earlier the superintendent was suspended for a portion of time by the time Glenn and others came in. So that's the only disciplinary I saw.
Well, Glenn Miller, I couldn't really tell from reading the judge's decision. He didn't break it down specifically, but it didn't seem like there was a great deal of disciplinary action taken against anybody who took part in this assault.
No, and unfortunately, let me use the sergeant as an example. Sergeant O'Neill was the person who supervised this incident. He was hands-on from the beginning until the end. Even after OSI's investigation was concluded, and OSI determined that Sergeant O'Neill failed to supervise his men, he was suspended for a grand total of 60 days. And then when he came back, he was on probation for a year. And then he continued with his job as a supervisor until he retired maybe a year ago. And now he's retired collecting his full pension.
Well, this fellow's name is O'Neill. He was a sergeant, huh? Right.
Yep.
And there were some lieutenants who, like, there was some other, like, sort of slap on the wrist for was that?
I mean, the deputy superintendents, both who were present, they might have been suspended also for maybe 60 days, and then they returned And then they both eventually retired many years later on full pension. A couple of lieutenants, a couple of captains, same slap on the wrist. They all resumed their jobs. Some of them are retired now, all collecting their pensions. Some of them are still working. As some far as the actual corrections officers, I think two of them were disciplined for filing false paperwork. Not one other corrections officer out of the 30-plus who got off that bus that morning were disciplined at all.
Say that last part again.
Not one of the corrections officers who got off that bus that morning that brought them to the dorm and entered the dorm and caused the havoc that Cole described, not one of them was disciplined.
Well, that says it all, I guess, right there. That says it all. Folks, this is WBAI 99.5 FM. The show's called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins, but more importantly, I'm talking to Glenn Miller, an attorney who's worked for many years on cases involving inmate abuse in New York's prisons and also in police cases, and to Cole Bryant, who was incarcerated at Mid-State Correctional Facility in July of 2016 when this incident we're talking about, where over two dozen officers who were never disciplined for it ran amok and started beating and assaulting and using racial slurs to talk about people and throwing things around. And as you were just told by Glenn Miller, the attorney, nobody who took part in the who came that day on a bus was ever disciplined. Let me remind folks, this is a station that runs on the generosity of our listeners. And even though our fund drive is over, it's still important for you to think about what you can do to keep us going. We need to keep the wolf from the door. We need to keep the antenna bill paid for, the rent here on Atlantic Avenue paid for. And if you want to help with that, here's the phone number. It's 833-922-4192. Or if your eyesight is better than mine and you can see those little letters on your phone, it's 833-WBAI-NYC. WBAI-NYC, 833-922-4192. See if you can find your way clear to digging into your pockets and coming up with $20, $30, $40, maybe $50. Be a sport and, you know, invest in this kind of radio, giving you insights into a story that really hasn't been told. Cole Bryant, let me ask you, you read or you heard about the death of this man named Robert Brooks at Marcy last month. What did you think when you heard about that?
Well, I know things like that go on regularly out there. So although it was awful to hear about, and the timing couldn't come, I mean, it came right after we heard the news about our own case. It was awful to hear that had to transpire. But it's in the same hub. And while I was out there, well removed from the actual incident, the officers were a lot of times transferred to other facilities. So you expect if they would do as much there, that these things could go on in other areas. So, yeah, and I saw it on a went on an Instagram blast first, and then later they had some YouTube footage put up, and then the regular local news.
So you watched the video?
I've watched portions of it.
Right.
I haven't seen the whole thing. It took a while for them to release it up in this area. He's from around here, so. But a lot of people were talking about it, just the clips that they had, or the incident before they actually produced the video. So I've only seen clips of it, not the whole thing.
Well, it just underscores, I guess, you know, the crucial role that video has been playing in these kinds of incidents. There was no There was no video when another of your clients, Glenn Miller, a guy named George Williams, was beaten almost to death in Attica back in 2014, I guess it was. And there was no video. Another story I wrote about the death of a man named Carl Taylor at Sullivan Correctional Facility, who was later found a civil trial here in federal court in Manhattan that his death had been caused by the guards who had beaten him that day. There was no video there. I mean, how often now, Glenn Miller, do you find that there is video that's retrievable in the incidents you investigate behind prison walls?
Retrieving video has become more commonplace than maybe even a couple of years ago. The problem with the video is the guards know where the videos are not. And all of a sudden, we're finding our clients being beaten in areas where there's no videos, such as bathrooms, strip frisk areas, private cells where they're not allowed to have cameras. And many of our cases now show through video clients being led into a cell or led into a frisk room. But you don't see what happens in there. And unfortunately, the guards typically come up with their own account of what happened.
Right.
What is unusual about the unfortunate incident with Mr. Brooks is that the cameras were not supposed to be on. The guards had cameras that were on a disabled mode, but they went off anyway. And unbeknownst to these 12 guards in the infirmary, their actions were being videotaped. And frankly, maybe to answer your question, Tom, that's really the only thing about the Brooks case that surprises me, that we actually finally got one on video.
Well, that's quite a statement. What about the response by the governor and other officials to this Cole Bryant? I mean, I looked to see whether or not there had ever been anything from the governor's office about the Mid-State case. Even after that court decision came down, I didn't see anything. Were you surprised to see the governor come down and calling for the firing of these guards in the Robert Brooks fatality case, Cole Bryant?
I was a little bit relieved that the cameras had such a great effect. Obviously, there had been several before, obviously several, including our own, that were overlooked, not a lot of support up at that level, and then, boom. Robert Brooks comes through in some immediate action from the highest level in the state. So, yeah, I was a little relieved. It really makes a statement, a good statement, that it's not going to be tolerated, and hopefully it'll change things moving forward.
Yeah, that's the hope, that it's not just political rhetoric, and that, you know, the fact that these videos exist, that there would be a kind of a George Floyd type response to this, where that videotape of the police compressing someone's neck for an abominable amount of time led to a revolt across the country and changes in policing in so many places. We would hope that the Robert Brooks videotape feeds that. Cole, let me ask you in the last couple minutes that we have, how have you been since this? Did this incident leave you with any lasting damage effect? You been okay?
Actually, so after it, I found out that I had a partially herniated disc, and that right. Once it pops out, it'll pop out again. And the only thing, through physical therapy, I learned that the only thing that was going to stop it was to strengthen the muscles around there. So that's what I've been stuck doing over the last 8 years, learning new exercises to do to keep the disc from popping out, seeing doctors, trying to see what the best.
How about your head? How about your head? How about, you know, just the fear factor? I mean, this is the.
Yeah, that too. That was a little nerve-wracking. The last year that I was out there, really nerve-wracking, really tried to play low-key. Didn't want any trouble from anyone, especially not any officers that I knew had been at that facility and showed up in the facility I was in. Really just tried to remove myself for any drama.
Yeah.
I was on a lot of light duty certificates, so I really didn't get to see much of anyone moving around. Mostly just...
All right. We got to go in a couple of seconds. Glenn Miller, you've got one more trial coming up. You got to, now that you've won this decision that the state is liable, you got to see for how much. When is that happening?
Well, the trial is going to start in May of this year. And once again, I'm going to have 28 clients testifying about not what happened. The judge already knows what happened, but they're going to testify about how it affected them, both physically and emotionally.
Right. All right. Well, you would think that given the current tenor of events, that just maybe the state of New York in its ultimate wisdom might see clear to settling this instead of going forward with another trial to put everybody through. But I guess that may be too much to hope for. We got to call it there. I want to thank you both, Cole Bryant and Glenn Miller, for taking the time this evening and walking us through this very tough story.
Thank you, John.
Thanks a lot. All right. Thanks, folks, for tuning in. Thanks, Reggie Johnson, for your ace engineering. As always, we'll let Oliver Nelson's stolen moments steal the last few moments of this show. Take care, everyone.
Good evening. I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news. United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, accused Israel's army of violating international law with attacks on hospitals in the Gaza Strip on Monday.
A human rights catastrophe continues to unfold in Gaza before the eyes of the world. Israel's means and methods of warfare have killed tens of thousands of people, inflicted vast displacement, and laid waste to the territory.
The charge comes as Israeli forces attack densely populated areas across Gaza, killing nearly 50 Palestinians over the weekend.
At least 136 strikes on at least 27 hospitals and 12 other medical facilities in Gaza, which caused significant death and injury among doctors, nurses, medical staff, and other civilians, and damaged or destroyed many of the buildings targeted.
Hamas and Israel are working on a potential ceasefire deal. Hamas says it's approved a list of 34 captives to be released in the first phase. The news comes as an eighth Palestinian baby has died of the cold. Winter is set in. More than 200 children are born every day in Gaza. And Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau moved to stem infighting within his Liberal Party on Monday by suspending Parliament and calling for new elections.
I intend to resign as party leader, as Prime Minister, after the party selects its next leader through a robust, nationwide, competitive process.
Trudeau rose to power as a Liberal firebrand and advocate of progressive values. His star dimmed when COVID restrictions sparked angry national protests led by truck drivers. President-elect Trump has referred to the Canadian leader derisively as Governor Trudeau and threatened crippling tariffs against Canada, America's largest trading partner. In national news, it was 4 years ago today the largely ceremonial counting of the electoral votes of the recent presidential election was assaulted by thousands of supporters of then-President Donald Trump.
I know that everyone here will soon be marching over to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make your voices heard.
Several people died related to the assault on the Capitol. A protester, Ashley Babbitt, was shot and killed. Officer Brian Sicknick had a stroke. Four other officers committed suicide in the days and months after the riot. The scene at the Capitol was calm on Monday, though, as Vice President Kamala Harris, who was defeated by Trump in 2024, announced the electoral vote count.
The votes for President of the United States are as follows. Donald J. Trump of the state of Florida has received 312 votes. Kamala D. Harris.
The public doesn't directly elect the president, but a college of representatives called electors make the final decision. Senator Chuck Schumer recounted his fear on that day 4 years ago.
All of a sudden, I felt a hand pull my collar. My security detail gripped me by the arm and told me we had to get out. A mob of rioters had broken into the Capitol and that we were not safe.
Congressperson Adriano Aspiat represents Inwood in Upper Manhattan and parts of the Bronx. He spoke with WBAI in January 2021.
Those guys came in with deadly intentions.
Why do you think it was deadly intentions?
They came with handcuffs, plastic handcuffs, to potentially kidnap some of the members. They set up a gallows and a noose and a rope to hang someone outside. And clearly they were chanting, hang by Pence, and they were looking for Pelosi. So these folks came in there. This was a killer mob that was incited by President Trump.
Did you expect this?
I didn't think they would get into the Capitol. But in the morning when I came in, I noticed that security was lax. And I just found it very strange that I was walking on the sidewalk with like 10 demonstrators. And they were able to just walk right into the complex the same way I did.